Welcome to Gaggle's podcast, It Takes a Village. We have a very special guest with us today, all the way from Australia joining us. Before I get going and introducing our guest, I just want to say that the topic of this podcast may be a little distressing to some of our listeners. So please just be aware of that as you're listening. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Jazz Rawlinson. Jazz is a best-selling author. She's got 3 published books, and she's also a resilient speaker. She's basically tackling topics that others tend to shy away from, you know, things such as like human trafficking, domestic violence, child abuse, and a lot of the topics of her recent book, as well as all 3 of her books, is suicide and mental health challenges. Jazz has spent time in Thailand with sex trafficking survivors and undercover rescue works. She's really well regarded for her ethical and empathetic journalism. She's published globally, and she lives in lovely Brisbane, Australia. So, Jazz, welcome. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Thank you. Thanks for the lovely introduction. And I was actually so impressed that you got the name of my city right, because most people in the US struggle with the word Brisbane, and they're always like, from Brisbane, Australia. So well done with that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for introducing me. And yeah, I mean, you pretty much, you know, gave a little sum up of what I do, but whenever I'm speaking to someone new, essentially, as I explain, what I really am is a storyteller. And what I really do is help people to live a life of purpose and break through adversity through the power of storytelling. And that's essentially what I do as both a book coach and also a resilient speaker as well.
Right. That's great. Well, can you tell us a little bit about your mission and a little more about your story? Is that something you want to start with?
Yeah, it's probably a good place to start. So I grew up in a beautiful little mountain valley here in on the east coast of Australia. And I think, you know, to a lot of people on the outside, I probably looked like I had a really idyllic childhood and everything looked pretty great. I got to grow up in this beautiful little valley with the mountains at my back doorstep. I had my own horse and I would, you know, go on adventures down the road and through the valley, and didn't have to worry really about a lot of things that kids have to think about these days. I definitely didn't have social media. I didn't have to really worry about my safety where we lived. So in a lot of ways, everything looked great. You know, I also went to a private school and, you know, I had a good group of friends around me. But what I didn't tell my friends and what a lot of people didn't know was that I was actually living in a home with family violence. And I remember, I think I was about 10 when I remember that violence starting. My father was the perpetrator of the violence. It was mostly mental, emotional, and verbal, although he was sometimes physically violent with my mom, although I didn't really see that very much. But it was a very difficult environment to grow up in, especially when you're a 10-year-old girl and you don't have any understanding of mental health and there's no understanding of what family violence is or what depression is. And I can't remember exactly when I found out what depression actually was, but I think I was probably around maybe age 11 or 12. I think I might have been in year 6. And somebody, I don't know whether it was my mom or who it was, showed me a printout of what the signs were of depression. And it was this really unusual feeling, because for the first time I knew why I was so depressed, but I also recognized that it felt like there was nothing I could do to change that. So I've shared about it in my books how it was kind of a bittersweet moment of going, okay, this is the name for what I'm going through. You know, this perpetual, you know, sorrow and misery that I'm just carrying around all the time actually has a name, but I don't know how I'm ever going to get rid of it. Because I couldn't ever imagine a a world where I wasn't going to be living with this family violence from my dad. So that's kind of a little summary of what I experienced from an early age. And that depression and anxiety hung around with me for a long time. I was very suicidal throughout my teens, and it was really, really hard to keep my head afloat. And that's why I'm really passionate about speaking out about mental health. And it's part of why I wrote my book series, Reasons to Live, because I want other young people to understand that the things that we experience, the traumas or the challenges, particularly the challenges we have in our youth, those do not have to be part of our story for our entire lives. And, you know, my story today is completely different to the one I had as a, 12, 14, 16-year-old, even 18-year-old. And so I speak very, in a very raw and real way about my experience, and that I was very depressed and very suicidal. And at that time, I didn't think I would ever come out of that. I didn't see a way through it. But I'm glad that I continued, you know, pushing on one, as I say, just taking it one day at a time, living one more day every single day until I came out the other side of that. And sadly, my dad did take his life when I was 18. So that, of course, opened the doors to, it was a whole other layer of trauma on top of a lot that I'd already experienced.
Right. It's like you had it from both your own personal feelings of depression, and then you're seeing somebody close to you also struggling, obviously, to the worst end. I remember I was looking at some of your books, and you talk about a very, very visual example of the way you felt was this like dark cloud or fog that you felt like you were in all the time. And I thought that was so true. And I feel like so many people have that, you know, I hear people, and I myself have felt this way. It's like you wake up in the morning and it's just so cold and dark and there's nothing. And I think that, you know, just understanding that this is not an uncommon thing for people to feel, and trying to figure out how to get help is so important, I think, for everybody to know, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I felt it was really important for us to talk today. Given what we do at Gaggle, you know, we worry about trying to find the kids who are struggling with these sorts of things. So trying to raise this awareness is so important. So I'm so sorry to hear about your dad. I feel like there's so many people I know. I think every single person who works at Gaggle probably has lost somebody to suicide. My father, you know, I lost him to suicide when I was in my 30s, which was strange, you know, at that age, because you feel like you've come through a certain like growth in your life, and then all of a sudden there's like this massive trauma.
I can imagine that would have been really difficult at that age. So different to the age I was, which was, you know, very shocking as an 18-year-old. But then when you're in your sort of young adulthood, or you feel like you're sort of hitting a stride and you're an adult and everything's hopefully pretty settled, to lose a family member at that age is, at any age, it's just shocking, you know. I feel like it doesn't matter what age you are or they are when you lose them, like the loss is still the same.
Absolutely. I just remember feeling like the anchor in my life was gone and I didn't see it coming. And I think that's a part of the thing with all of this, is that you yourself don't realize how badly you feel, and also you don't necessarily know the people that you're close to are struggling with this sort of thing until something terrible happens, which is why it's so important for people to be talking about this. And so I'm so happy that you've written the books that you've written and shared. I mean, so tell us a little bit about your books. There are a lot of great stories in those books from some really interesting people. So tell me a little bit about the thinking behind that, how that all came to be.
Yeah, thank you. And the stories, they really are incredible. I've worked with close to 36 people now to write and publish their stories, and you know, so many common themes between them, but so unique in their own way as well. But, you know, like to come back to the beginning, like for anyone who hasn't heard of Reasons to Live before, it really just started from this idea that just came to me one night when I was, it was like a late night road trip. I was heading down south to see my mom. And I think I was just like thinking about a lot of stuff, trying to keep myself entertained. And I had this thought about how, about this ABC article that I read recently that was saying that here in Australia, we're losing, you know, 2,500 people a year to suicide, which is a lot for the size of our country, which equated to about, you know, 6 to 8 people every day, mostly men. And so that got me thinking about my own story and about how much I'd come through and about, you know, my dad being one of those statistics and how close, you know, I came as well to being one of those statistics. And I just started thinking about all the children, about the statistics I'd heard in this article about how many kids were taking their lives these days. And I think that was the most shocking part. And it was just heartbreaking to me, especially to hear of how many Aboriginal children here in Australia were taking their lives or trying to take their lives from really, really young ages, like 9 and 10 years old. And it was heartbreaking. So I thought, you know, it would be amazing if I was able to use my story to somehow give hope to, you know, the kids who were in the same position when I was a 10-year-old girl going through depression, you know, when I was a 13 and 14-year-old girl who was struggling with body image issues and a lot of disordered eating issues as well. And yeah, I just thought, well, what could I do? So where could I use my skills now as a writer and a freelance journalist? And that was kind of the spark that got me thinking about creating a project around mental health awareness and lived experience stories. And that set me off on a journey of about 9 months of finding people all across Australia. The first book was just Australian stories, but the books afterwards have been stories from all around the world. So finding people from around Australia for that first book and just asking them, you know, what was one of the toughest things that you experienced in your life? And what actually helped you get through that? You know, was it conventional mental health support and psychologists and things like that and antidepressants? Or was it art therapy? Or was it music? Or was it something else? You know, was it just having a good friend? What was it that actually worked for you? Because I know that for my dad, he certainly was never going to seek help from a traditional kind of, you know, therapeutic source. He wouldn't even take vitamins because to him that seemed like a weak thing to do. As a man, apparently, you know, in his mind, that meant that he was weak and struggling. So therefore he wouldn't even take supplements to help with his mood. And so it was really important to me to have a mix of male and female voices talking about what had helped them, and particularly those who had found a way through the darkness, not solely through call support lines or psychologists, but yeah, just finding out what worked for different people so that I could collate this into a book that would give hope to other people and give them lots of different little snippets of wisdom from people's lived experiences. And over the past 4 years, that's, you know, turned into this book series, Reasons to Live One More Day Every Day. And it's three books in the series. I've just released and published the third and final volume. And as I said, stories from all across the world and lots of mental health resources in there as well. And one thing that was really important to me that I was really passionate about was including a section that I like to call, it's like my handpicked mental health warrior section, or in the third book, it's called Good People Doing Good Things. And that's just a section where I actually list lots of amazing people I've met from around the world and, you know, organizations like Gaggle who are doing great things to change lives for, you know, kids and for men and women across the world. And they're not, you know, getting the same accolades or publicity as, say, the really, really big orgs, but the work that they're doing is just as important and just as life-changing. And so that's why I've included that section.
No, that's great. I think it takes a village, right? I mean, it takes all different sorts of big organizations and associations and small groups and friends. And like you said, all the different ways that people are finding their way through this darkness. I noticed in, I think it was in the third book and possibly in the second book, you talked a lot about resilience as something important that you've learned and felt that that was something that people could really try to develop and use to try to get through and then thrive. So, you know, get through the problems and then turn the corner and have a wonderful life. So this whole concept of resilience, I wonder if you could just talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you're right. It was a really big theme of the third book, and I thought it was really important to include because, you know, when we look at what actually helps people thrive after, you know, or firstly survive and get through what they're experiencing, but to also be able to thrive and thrive despite the ongoing challenges that will appear throughout their lives, you know, because our lives are not going to be smooth sailing every day and every year of our entire lives. And it really came back to resilience. And that was the core theme that I found, not just for my own story, but, you know, close to 3 dozen people and clients that I've worked with in the past 4 years to bring their stories to life. You know, we're talking about people that have gone through, like you're saying, that have been through child abuse and exploitation and domestic violence, disabilities and chronic pain, eating disorders, PTSD. And without learning how to craft and build that resilience, it's incredibly hard to thrive and to keep going when challenges keep presenting themselves. So that was why I really wanted it to be a big focus of the book, particularly with what is going on in our world at the moment. People are being challenged in ways that they have never known. And there's a lot of stuff that's very, very unknown at the moment. So that's why I also wanted to talk about resilience and the fact that, you know, some people feel that they learn their resilience very early on. I know I certainly did. Others may have had quite a smooth sailing life, and so they didn't really need to learn much about resilience until later on. But the great thing is that, as I say in the third book, you know, there's never been a better time to start building your resilience. And it's something that anybody can build upon and have as a foundation in their life. And it just takes work to build that. And it's kind of tricky to talk about, you know, how to build resilience. But one of the things that I often say to people is, I think when I was going through a lot of things in my teens and also my early 20s, I would try to remind myself that, you know, this is a moment that will pass. And right now it feels all consuming, but it will pass. And eventually I'll be on the other side of that. And even in my life currently, when things come up that are hugely overwhelming or create extreme panic for me, I try to remind myself of something that's happened in the past where I felt this way. And I ask myself, was there ever a time where I didn't get through this? Was there ever a time where I couldn't work this out or it didn't eventually, you know, right itself in some way? And the answer for me has always been no. Like, I've always been able to get through it. I've always been able to find a way to overcome it or to work with it or find a solution. And I think that's, if there's anyone listening that's just thinking, you know, how can I actually build my resilience? The number one thing is just coming to understand that there will be challenges in life and it may be really dark and you may not even know for a long time how long it's going to take to get through this. You know, just speaking about what our world is going through right now, we don't know what the timeline is for this, but I do know that it's not going to be this way forever. It's just not possible. So we will come out the other side of it. And it's just about having the persistence until things change.
And what you say is this whole idea about one day, like if you can get through the day that you're in, then there'll be the next day. And it's like, if you can just shorten your horizon to be thinking about, let's do today.
Absolutely.
And not stress out about the 5,000 million more days that are coming, you know.
That actually, and sorry to interrupt, but it actually reminds me of a story in the third book, which is from a first responder by the name of Matt Newlands. And he talks about his journey through PTSD as a police officer and, you know, joining the police force as a 21-year-old and wanting to, you know, like for him, he just really wanted to change lives and be a great, you know, great member of society who was helping to make life better for people. Like that was his perspective. And he said he did kind of have those rose-tinted glasses as a 20 and 21-year-old, but that's what he wanted to do. But going into the police force at age, you know, sort of 20 and 21 and experiencing death and horror and all kinds of things like that on a pretty much daily basis for a 10-year period of time really took its toll on him. And when he talks about getting to this absolute rock bottom moment where he actually was convicted of a crime, he lost his job, he was in the thick of PTSD, planning to take his own life, and he had to find a way to find the resilience and the persistence to get through that. And he talks about that borrowing belief. So it was a strategy that he learned from a Olympic athlete, Tora Bright, I think her name is. And she had this strategy of borrowing belief. And so in times where you weren't sure if you were going to come through something, she would borrow belief from, I think it was from her brother or from somebody else who believed in her. And so he would borrow belief from, you know, one or two close mates who were checking in on him every day. And he talks about how it really was just about getting through the night to the next day, exactly as you were just saying. And so that's what reminded me of his story. But yeah, it's just about taking it one day, getting through this day to the next, and just continuing on.
Right. And then eventually getting through it and developing some hope, right? I mean, I think it's the lack of hope that can sometimes make things so difficult for people, but you take it day by day and, you know, eventually you get there. One of the things that you've also talked about when we've spoken previously and I've seen in your books is the work that you've done with human trafficking and domestic violence, you know, so just take the focus off of the mental health and depression side of things for a minute. Tell us a little bit more about what your work was in the sex trafficking area.
Yeah, so I first became aware of the issue when I was in my mid-20s and I was between jobs, and I was in quite a hopeless period of time myself. I had no idea where the direction of my life was going. It didn't feel like there really was a direction. And I was really stuck in that hopelessness. And I went along to this festival where I was volunteering as a photojournalist. And I remember walking into this tent just to see what was going on in there. And there was kind of a little movie theater set up and some stalls. And there was this movie playing. And it was a documentary, I think, about children who'd been rescued from human trafficking. And I was just so shocked. I hadn't really heard a lot about human trafficking at that stage. And when I walked around that room and I looked at the tables and saw these photographs of these young girls who needed sponsors, and I saw that some of them had on their, you know, the little notes beside their photos, I saw that some of them had been out of, you know, trafficking in the sex industry for, say, you know, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And I looked at their ages, and their ages were 14, 15, 13. You know, there were 10-year-olds, there were babies, you know, there were children who had been rescued as toddlers. There were girls who were 13 or 14 or 15 now, and they'd been out for 3 years. It was just horrendous. And I just couldn't believe that this could actually be a world that we were living in. And I remember I didn't have a job at the time, and I didn't really have any income except for, you know, sort of government benefits, which are very hard to live on. And I just knew that I had to be part of the solution. You know, I didn't want to live in a world where this was happening, but I just ignored it. And so I made a decision to sponsor one of the girls, which was through this this organization, Destiny Rescue. And I kind of didn't look back. And then after that, I started to do some just some blogging and writing around the issue of human trafficking. And then a couple of years later, I ended up going overseas with some other people to learn about the work that Destiny Rescue was doing. And so as part of that, we went to the red light districts where they had actually rescued children. We saw a building where they had rescued children only a week or two beforehand. And all around it were bars and clubs that were still operating. And, you know, I would look at the faces of these girls as we walked past, and they just looked so, so filled with hopelessness, you know. And it was really eye-opening to walk through there and see particularly so many Western men sitting in there purchasing these girls who literally had numbers strapped to their bodies. And so a man would go in there and say, I want number 5, I want number 10, you know. And for me to know what was happening to these girls behind the scenes when the smiles faded and they weren't standing out the front and they didn't have to put their mask on, it was just horrific. But the other part of that was that we then also went to the prevention homes or the rescue homes where girls had been given a new life and they were able to learn a trade. And, you know, we visited restaurants, a Destiny Rescue restaurant where some of the girls had been training in hospitality and were now working as chefs and as waitresses and cooks. And it was just beautiful to see that they were actually being given the training to become empowered and live a different life. So it wasn't just about rescuing them out of there and giving them a safe place to live and then them depending on, you know, white people and a sort of like white savior type mentality. It wasn't that. It was great to see that they were actually being given the training to have a different life and then to then go and, you know, live their own life, you know, whether they wanted to move back to close to their family or set up a, you know, we saw some girls who were working in hairdressing salons and I helped to renovate, it's like a 3-story house that was being converted into a salon for a young woman. So it was great to be able to see that they were able to go on and live an empowered life. So there were really difficult things that I experienced and witnessed, particularly in the red light districts and seeing these girls, but then to see the other end of it and see them happy and smiling and, you know, living the lives that they should be living as young girls and studying. And yeah, it was just beautiful. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting the way you're describing this is it's like, there's many problems there, right? There's just the fact that there's this sex trafficking thing that's happening at all. And they're having that terrible, horrific life. But then, I mean, if they're little children and young girls and then they get rescued, like, what do they do then? I mean, it's like they've missed the education, they've missed those key years of development and growing up and being with their friends. And all of a sudden, they're thrown into this world of like, now what? So I think what is Destiny Rescue doing is, I mean, helping them when they're coming through it and being saved, I think, is so important.
Because they've got to go through, obviously, there's the there's just the survival part of it. I mean, there's so much that goes into it that, you know, I could talk about for hours, but, you know, actually just getting them out of these situations takes a long time because they don't swoop in there and drag them out of there and take them to a better life. You know, they have to build relationships with these young girls, and sometimes there's boys that they've found as well, and actually build a relationship until they trust them enough that they're ready to say, I want to leave this place and I want to come with you. And then obviously it's different when they're working with police and the police are doing a raid because there's underage children there and they need to get them out. But certainly for, you know, a lot of girls or those who are 18 and over, they have to build a relationship as well. But they said that it's very common when children or young girls are rescued, it's very common for them to sleep for, 48 hours when they get to the rescue home, because they finally have somewhere that they are safe and they can let their guard down. And, 2 to 3 days, they said they'll just sleep. And so that's before they can even begin to, obviously the healing process is a long one. And then they're able to offer them the opportunity to, to be educated and to get their high school degree or whatever the equivalent is where they are, and to be able to get jobs as well, because a lot of these girls come from hill tribes, which means that they don't even have passports or ID. So you can also understand why so many end up in the sex industry and don't leave and spend most of their lives there until either something terrible happens to them or, because there's no other option. If you don't have ID and you don't have an education and you don't have a passport, then there's nothing else to go to. So for them to have, an organization that can actually give them employment and set them up for, hopefully for them to go on and have a successful life is amazing. But that's a common thing that a lot of people don't realize as to why so many of these girls and women stay there. And there are these myths about, they look at her, she's smiling, she's happy, she wants to be there, she's not underage. And what they don't realize is that many of these girls have been there since they were underage, or they were exploited through their families as children. So they've already experienced sexual trauma. So the next step for many people who have experienced childhood trauma is to go into situations that feel familiar. And then when you couple that with economic disadvantage and poverty, it's no wonder that, women are in this industry, because they feel they have, there's little else for them. So,
right. It's a problem worldwide. In the United States.
Yeah, certainly not. It's certainly not tied to Thailand. Average age of entry into, they say entry into prostitution, but really it's child abuse and trafficking in the United States is age 13. It's certainly not a third world issue.
No, and not at all. I mean, it's something I think, we as a company are trying to shed a little more light on. We do focus a lot on depression, but we also seeing what students are talking about. We see them talking, and we see child predators trying to actually reach out to these young children and entice them. And we've actually helped police catch child predators because of luckily we've been able to see the conversations, but these children don't know what's going on. It's crazy what they're being faced with. So it's all over the world. I don't think enough people are aware of it. I was in Atlanta airport in Georgia recently, and they have it plastered over all the bathrooms and on the walls, and they have public service announcements. If you're there and you're not there of your own volition, or if you see somebody that does, if something doesn't look right to you, call this number right away. So there's such a, I guess Atlanta and Las Vegas and a couple of other airports in the United
Definitely
States are
Las Vegas, yeah. Yeah. But I have heard that the airline industry particularly has been trying to educate their staff about the signs of human trafficking. And there've been amazing stories of, flight crew spotting somebody who does not, a very young person with a much older person who does not look comfortable, cannot speak for themselves. The older person will speak for them. And so there's, lots of signs to look out for. So I'm really glad to hear that there are actually a lot of signs and posters up around airports now. I haven't been to an airport for almost 2 years now, but I'm not sure that we really have that much awareness in Australia, even though Australia is still a destination country for for trafficking as well. So it's great to hear that there is at least a lot more awareness, particularly within the airline industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's becoming more noticeable, but I still think there's an awful lot of work to do to try to
get
rid of it. So, okay, well, that was a very interesting conversation regarding all that. I mean, that it's very powerful what you described with these young girls. It's just so disturbing. So anything we can do to try to help turn the tide on that. So Destiny, tell me again the name of that.
Yeah. So there's actually two organizations that I'm an ambassador for. One is Destiny Rescue. And the second one is Project Karma. And they're both Australian registered organizations or charities doing similar things, you know, but in different ways as well. I know Project Karma does a lot within, they're doing a lot within Australia, but also in countries, places like Indonesia and Jakarta and places like mm-hmm. that as well. But yeah, there's many different organizations out there. Those are the two that I support. Mm-hmm. And particularly because they are looking at things happening within Australia and, you know, first world nations as well as third world countries as well.
Right. So coming back to like the beginning of all this, is there anything that you would like to share with our listeners in terms of if they're feeling in a dark place? You've talked about the resilience. Is there anything else?
I get where you're I totally get what you're saying. And I think what I often like to share with people is, as you know, firstly, as I've said, it's about understanding that you will get through this. If you continue on, you will get through this. But another thing I like to share is that if you have a loved one or a friend, someone in your community who is struggling, I feel like it's really important to understand that as much as we want to try and fix the situation that they're going through or fix their depression or whatever they're experiencing, sometimes all they really need is someone to listen. So rather than someone jumping in and trying to fix everything and give all their advice, which I know, like, I want to do that for my friends, it's hard to hold myself back. But I know that when I've been struggling, sometimes I don't want someone to just jump in and just throw all their advice and have you tried this and have you done that? And, you know, often you just want someone to start by listening. And that's a really big thing for a lot of people. Like, I think about my dad, you know, if he had been, you know, maybe if he had been born, you know, a few decades later and he'd grown up with more mental health awareness, he may have understood that if he just picked somebody around him that he trusted and opened up to them, that things may have, you know, he may have realized that he could actually get through what he was experiencing. So it's a big thing for people to reach out to us and share what they're going through. And the best thing you can do is hold space for that person and just let them know that you're actually there for them. And then if they're looking for, you know, ideas or advice, obviously you can speak with them. And of course it's different if that person is talking about taking their life. If you are worried about that person's safety, then you must call, you know, 911 or 000, you know, maybe arrange to go to their doctor with them if you're close to them. But if it's just a conversation from somebody about, you know, not doing well and they just want to vent to someone, just hold that space for them and listen.
That's great. And then for the people that are listening to this podcast who may feel that they're the ones in the dark place, I think that idea of reaching out and doing exactly what you just said, but in the reverse, like you should talk to somebody, whoever that may be. And in the United States, we have the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which people are there 24/7 and will listen to you if you're needing somebody to talk to. So I'm just going to say that number. So it's 800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. And I believe in Australia you have one as well, right?
Yeah, we have Lifeline, which is 13, 11, 14. And you're completely right. It's just important to reach out to someone, and whether that is a doctor or your psychologist, or whether it is one of these, you know, like one of the talk lines, or whether it's a friend, or, you know, maybe it's an internet friend that you have that you talk to quite a lot and you've never actually met in person. But as long as you pick someone that you feel you can trust, that's the most important thing. And just open up to them. That's the most important thing you can do when you're in that dark place. I mean, I just say to people, I don't want you to become another statistic like my dad. I don't want you to be another statistic like so many friends of friends that I have, you know. So talking to somebody could actually save your life. So please find that little piece of bravery and reach out to someone.
That's excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your taking the time today. You're on the other side of the world from me and, you know, other side of the day, you're tomorrow. So I really appreciate your making this podcast with us here at Gaggle. And we'll put in our blog information about your books so that people can get them.
Thank you. And if anybody wants to grab the Reasons to Live series, you can just get it at jazzrawlinson.com/books. They are, for those who are international, you can order them through the site, or you can also find them on most of your big online retailers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if anybody is interested in writing their life story and working with a book coach, then you're welcome to reach out through jazzrawlinson.com as well.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your taking the time, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime in the not too distant future. So
yes,
keep up all the work you're doing. It's awesome.
And you too. I really appreciate the work that Gaggle's doing. So yeah, thank you so much.